By a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Enter the WILL sweepstakes today and you could win a widescreen, high-definition TV from Champaign Audio, a $1,000 gift certificate from Techline, an area rug from Sweeney Brothers Rug Gallery, or an AgriFab lawn vac. And if your entry is postmarked by August 19th, you'll be eligible to win the Early Bird Prize, $500 worth of colorful plants and shrubs for your garden from Country Arbors. If you need an entry form, give us a call at 217-333-0850. Don't wait. Send your entry in today.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Danzel, Jason Croft is at the controls. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll have our monthly visit with Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. And we have her with us monthly when things are growing. Spring, summer, early fall, to talk about lawn and garden care. So if you have some problem, need some advice, you can call in and talk with her. Then in the second hour tomorrow, we will turn again to the Focus 580 archives, and we'll have an interview I certainly enjoyed, and a lot of people told me when they heard it, they got a kick out of it. And this was a conversation with a fellow named Steve Almond, and yes, that is his real name. He teaches creative writing at Boston College, and he's written a book about candy and his personal obsession with it, and also a little bit about the business of candy. One of the things that he did when he was writing the book is to visit a lot of small candy makers around the country, and there are some that are in there trying to do battle with the very big companies like Hershey and Mars. And he would say turning out on a smaller scale some very high-quality products. So if you enjoy candy, you might, and you didn't hear this the first time around, you might want to check it out, but have a Hershey bar nearby because you'll want one before the end of the show. That's tomorrow. The book is called Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and your comments. And certainly we'll be welcoming your questions this morning, healthcare questions, as we say hello once again to Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic in Urbana. And every other month, he is here. It's always on a Monday and in the 11 o'clock hour. He's here and we're open to your questions. He deals with people of all ages in his practice, grown-ups, children. And here's people who have a wide variety of health complaints. So it's kind of a general sort of thing. We call it talk to the family doctor. And whatever's on your mind, if you give us a call, he will do his best to help you out. Again, as I always remind people when we do shows with doctors, you have to keep in mind that because the doctor can't see you, that there's some limits on what he can do. We can't diagnose over the phone, but this is a place to start. If you have some general kinds of healthcare questions, you'd like to have some background on particular concerns that you have, I know he'll try to help you out. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Thanks for being here once again.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be back.
How's things going this summer? Anything really? This is probably a fairly quiet time of the year?
It is, relatively speaking, a pretty healthy time of year. We've been very fortunate with the weather of late. The bugs haven't been too bad. And everybody's right now gearing up to go back to school.
Yeah, you're doing a lot of school physicals?
A lot of school physicals.
Okay. Well, we have a caller to start out with in St. Joe. We'll just go right there, and it's line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm a type 2 diabetic, diet control, and my question is regarding the frequency for checking my blood sugar level. First, it may be good for you to know that my glycohemoglobin, the average is about 5.7%, and that's my checked annually, and that's for the last about 5 years or so. My blood sugar has been running about 110 for the past 5 years. When I check my blood sugar with the glucometer before breakfast, it's run about 98 milligrams per deciliter. So I wondered, what's your suggestion for the frequency for checking, for me checking my blood sugar level?
One, you're to be congratulated on the excellent control that you've established for yourself. Your fasting blood sugars are actually in the normal range, and your glycohemoglobin is indistinguishable from somebody who doesn't have diabetes. So I think you're doing an excellent job. In fact, in a situation like this where you're not taking medication but simply watching your diet, getting some exercise, periodically getting your long-term blood sugar control checked with the glycohemoglobin, I'm not sure that there's really any reason why you need to frequently check your own blood sugar. If you have an established pattern of diet, exercise, and don't have any new intervening illness or medications, there really isn't any reason to expect your blood sugar to suddenly change.
Great.
So you have a long track record of very normal sugars. Unless there's a specific change in your lifestyle, whether it's diet, exercise, weight, a new medication, or if there's an intervening illness, I'm not sure that you gain a heck of a lot by checking your sugar on a daily basis.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because I really don't enjoy sticking myself in the...
Perfectly understandable.
All right, yeah.
And you should be rewarded for your good efforts by not having to do it quite as often.
Great. Okay, thanks a lot. Appreciate
it. All right. Very good. Thank you. And we have some other calls coming in here. Just let me give you our number again. And here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. I'm not sure I gave it at the beginning. I'm saying again, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And the next caller is in Mattoon, and that's on our line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My husband was just recently had a bout with diverticulitis. And unfortunately, the doctor kind of told him to avoid nuts and popcorn, but he didn't go into more specific. And I was wondering what other foods he really should try and avoid.
When there's an acute flare-up of diverticulitis, it's nice to try and avoid any sort of non-digestible parts and seeds, nuts, non-digestible fibers, peanut hulls, popcorn shells, things along those lines can all potentially get caught in a diverticulum, which is just a little outpouching on the bowel wall. Most adults over the age of 50 probably have a few diverticulae in their colon, and in and of themselves they really don't have a lot of significance. But occasionally something will get caught in one of those little pockets and form a little abscess, a little area of infection and inflammation, and that can cause some fever, discomfort in the lower abdomen, typically on the left. And in bad instances, diverticulitis can cause perforation of the colon, in which case then it needs to be surgically repaired. But in most instances, in general, a high fiber diet is recommended for diverticulitis in the long run. But during acute flare-ups, avoiding things that are going to get caught in those little pockets like sesame seeds and peanut shells and popcorn hulls and nuts and other undigested types of fiber is probably a reasonable thing to do.
Well, I was wondering about like sweet corn and tomatoes. Someone had said that he shouldn't eat those.
Again, if it comes through fairly undigested, it's probably a reasonable thing to do to avoid.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And the next caller in line here is in Terre Haute on line number two. Hello.
Yes, how are you this morning?
Good.
Just want to say thank you for doctors. I think they're a godsend.
Well, thank you.
And I had a product. I didn't know if you wanted to... comment on it that my dad, he's 80 years old and taking care of himself, and every time I call him he says he feels like a youngster, so I listen to him when he tells me about things. But Proxergen, had you heard of that? It has red raspberry in it and then another product I can't pronounce.
It sounds like from the expression on the doctor's face, I'd say the answer is no. What is it alleged to do for you?
Well, it's supposed to go in at the cellular level and help. There's things that as you get older, your body depletes and doesn't make anymore. And the one product that's in it is it beefs that up, and it helps repair and do several things. I had done some studying on it, but my father had really good luck with it, and I was just getting ready to try some of it.
I'm afraid I have absolutely no knowledge whatsoever of this product.
Okay, it came out of the University of Illinois. I guess some studies had been done on it, but it's called Proxergen. And I was just wondering on that. And I pretty well take herbs and try to keep myself pretty healthy and hope I follow in his footsteps, you know.
Well, it sounds like he's setting a good example at 80.
Right. Well, listen, I thank you guys for the show, and
okay.
Have a good day the rest of the day.
All right, very good. Thank you for the call.
Bye.
I guess we just go on here, and we talk to somebody next in Champaign, and that would be line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello, this is Blanca, and thank you for listening to me. I have a question for the doctor. I have a pain in my legs. The pain is in my calves. So I went to the doctor many times, and they don't know what it causes the pain. And I've been suffering for that pain for more than 20 years. It's sometimes the pain is unbearable, and sometimes I don't have any pain at all. And I can't stand on my feet at all. What's the best medicine? What can I do for that? Exercise, or what can I do?
I'm afraid this is going to fall into the category of not being able to make a diagnosis over the airwaves.
Yes.
The possibility of pain in your calves raises a number of potential questions related to the circulation into the legs, the nerve supply in those areas. There are certainly a number of different things that we would look for on physical examination to kind of give us a clue as to where this might be coming from.
Yes.
None of which I'm going to be able to do over the radio.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But the general comment that regular exercise, improving muscle tone in the lower extremities is probably a safe one. The fact that you've had it this long probably implies that it's not anything terribly dangerous, because I would have assumed that something bad would have happened by now.
Yes.
If it was. So I think things like blood clots in your legs can probably fairly safely be eliminated from our list of concerns.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much for your answer.
All right. Well, again, thank you for the call. We're here this morning on Focus 580 doing the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor, and our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here every other month to answer questions, and I know he will do his best. As I said at the beginning of the program, that it's not always easy for us to do this over the telephone because the doctor can't see you. But at the same time, I don't want to discourage anybody from calling, because we have been doing this for quite a while now. We hope that it will add to people's health knowledge, and it is a place to start. And of course, then if you have concerns, you obviously should pursue those with somebody who can see you. But you can start here, 333-9455, and toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe we go back and talk just for a second more about diverticulitis, just because this is something that a few years ago, I'm not sure that I ever heard of this. Is this something that is becoming more common, or is it simply something that is we're now just hearing about and seem to be maybe more aware of?
I think probably the latter. The condition itself has been around for a long time and is relatively common. It's generally probably more prominent in societies where there is less roughage in the diet. And since the American diet is fairly highly refined, we don't get quite the amount of fiber that would probably be recommended. It is thought that these protrusions of the lining of the bowel are coming out through the spaces between the muscles of the colon wall. If you think of what happens if you kind of try and, with your hand, squeeze a partially blown up balloon. Part of the balloon will protrude between your fingers. And that's kind of what a diverticulum is like. If you were inside the balloon, you would see this little outpouching going out between the fingers. And this kind of represents the lining of the bowel and the surrounding musculature of the colon. In situations where, again, some undigested food particle gets stuck in that little pocket, it can set up a little place for infection to get started. That can produce diverticulitis, which is the inflammatory component of this, and again, in really bad situations, can actually lead to a perforation or an opening from the bowel then into the inside the abdominal cavity, and this obviously is not a good place to get bacteria, and frequently, in addition to antibiotics, needs a surgery as well.
Mm. And what sort of symptoms would you see in somebody who had that condition?
Diverticula are most likely to be found and most likely to be symptomatic in the left lower portion of the abdomen, in that portion of the colon referred to as the sigmoid, where it curves and turns and moves down into the pelvis. So typically people will come in with left lower quadrant abdominal pain. They may have some fever associated with the infectious process, and they may have some change in their stools as well. Mild cases can sometimes be treated with just resting the intestinal tract and some oral antibiotics. More severe cases may require intravenous antibiotics, and again, the really bad cases involving perforation may need surgery.
Hmm. Is that something that tends to run in families?
Not necessarily, but diverticula themselves are really quite common. You'd probably find a few in just about everybody over the age of 50.
Yeah, okay, so this is yet another reason that you want to have the recommended amount of fiber in your diet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Our guest this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen, and we're here to take your questions, 333-9455, here for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we have another Champaign caller, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm concerned about a weight loss. I'm taking statins for high or LDL, bad cholesterol, and I've gone from 139 down to about 89, which is certainly good. But this is about 6 months, but I've been really losing weight, and I thought, is this typical of that or a result of statins?
No, it's not.
It's not?
No. And any significant weight loss should not be attributed to the medication. Now, if in addition to the medication you've made some significant changes in your diet in an attempt to lower your cholesterol, you can sometimes reduce enough fat that you'll lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, people will record or report diarrhea as a side effect of the statin medications. But again, this is usually not sufficient enough to cause a great deal of weight loss. So I would be inclined, if you're aware of this, to make your physician aware of it so that that can be investigated as a separate concern,
right,
because it should not be a direct side effect of the medication.
Okay, it answers my question. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Just for a second, let me ask a question about cholesterol-lowering medication, since recently there's been some controversy about this in the news. Not very long ago, people might recall, a new study or new report was issued looking at the target ranges, as I remember, sort of what the target ranges of people's cholesterol should be. And that the headline kind of was that doctors say cholesterol, now today doctors say your cholesterol should be lower than what we were saying, you know, a couple weeks ago.
Right.
And that as a result, that also it looked like probably more people would be candidates for cholesterol-lowering medication than had been on the medication before. And then shortly after that story, we got the wrinkle that says, well, some of the doctors who were involved in this study may have some connections with the companies that make the medication. So how do you think about this now in terms of, you know, what's for, you know, for your patients, what's the number that you would be looking for, and at what point would you start thinking about maybe you've done the other things that you can do, lifestyle-related, and that you might be thinking that somebody should be on a cholesterol-lowering medication?
This is a good question, a fairly complex one. The study that you're referring to was a relatively small study. It was not thousands and thousands of patients. And they were all patients who had known heart disease. What question then comes from the results, which basically emphasized that patients who were on high-dose statins and had significantly lower LDL seemed to do better from a cardiac standpoint over a fairly short period of time. So what you can say in heart disease patients over a short period of time is that lowering their LDL seemed to have some benefit. The question is can you generalize that to the whole population? People who don't have heart disease, is this applicable to them? Is lower better? And the answer is maybe, maybe not. Those studies really, you know, as in many instances in medicine, the answers provided by one study simply generate more questions that then need to be answered within another study. So I think in heart disease patients, you probably wouldn't be faulted by anybody by being fairly aggressive about lowering their LDL, their bad cholesterol. The question becomes is, you know, are you going to take a 22-year-old healthy woman with no cardiac risk factors who has an LDL of, you know, 101 and say, well, you need to be on medication to get your LDL, you know, under 60. Mm-hmm. That there isn't data for that right now, you know. So I don't think anybody's going to recommend that at this point. But what needs to be done is to see if the studies that are applicable to heart disease patients on a treatment basis are going to be applicable to the general population on a preventive basis, because that's really what we're talking about, is if we know that lowering your LDL reduces your chances of having recurrent heart disease, the question is, does lowering your LDL aggressively prevent the first expression of any heart disease? Mm. Now, it seems logical to sort of assume that, but in fact, you would be committing a whole lot of people to a whole lot of medication for a long, long period of time. Now, your comment about the physicians working in concert with the drug companies, this is a situation where these are the people who do the research, and the medications and the funding for the programs in many instances comes from those companies. So that's not necessarily terribly surprising to find out. You know, the real question is does it influence the outcome of the study? And this is why, in many instances, when a first study comes out, other investigators then try to replicate their results. If it basically can't be replicated, then maybe the conclusions drawn from that first study really weren't legitimate. Mm-hmm. But if it can indeed be replicated by other researchers in other places, then this may indeed be a real finding.
Okay. Well, now perhaps I didn't read the stories very carefully, but the way that you laid it out makes it seem that you have to be careful in looking, what is the patient population that you're studying?
Exactly.
And then you got to be careful about making this big leap past those people to everybody else. Mm-hmm. And it sounds as if maybe somebody was making the leap, or at least was raising the question, and maybe that is a perfectly good question. Okay, based on what we know about these people, would it be advisable to do something different with these people over here?
Right. And at least in the United States, anything that gets people aware of and thinking about getting their cholesterol down is probably a good thing. The numbers that we use in the United States for, quote, normal cholesterol are based on sort of average American values. And part of the situation that we're seeing right now with numbers being changed is reflective of the fact that when you compare the United States to the rest of the world, everybody's cholesterol is high in the United States. So the average cholesterol in the rest of the world is about 150. Mm-hmm. And yet we say up to 200 is normal in the United States. Well, that gives a lot of people a lot of extra cholesterol that's not running around in the rest of the world. Now, that's not to say that, you know, I want to live in a third world country just to lower my cholesterol. Those people are dying of other things, but it's probably not heart disease.
Yeah.
Okay, but here in the United States, where heart disease still remains the number one killer, the attention to cholesterol is probably an important thing to do. But I don't believe that it all has to be done with medication. There is a tremendous opportunity for people with changing their diet and exercise habits and losing some weight to make a real, real positive impact on their cholesterol.
Yeah. Okay, but Doc, couldn't I just have a pill?
That is the typical American response. I want the pill that still allows me to drive through McDonald's.
Okay. Well, I better be careful about claiming to be any better than anybody else. Let's go on here. We have another caller, Chicago, line number four, right here. Hello.
Hello. I have a two-part question. I read an article some time ago that said that in the United States we have a lot of undiagnosed food poisoning that quite often we think it's like a 24-hour bug or stomach flu. And then in the last 4 months, there have been two national recalls on almonds for salmonella. And so my questions are, one, how are almonds infected with salmonella? I had never thought of the two before. And secondly, what if the food poison is undiagnosed? That means it's probably untreated as well. And what long-term effects does untreated food poisoning have, especially for age groups like seniors and young children?
You have a good question about food poisoning. It's difficult to make that particular diagnosis in situations where it's just an individual patient presenting with symptoms. Mm-hmm. When one person comes in and says, you know, last night I had vomiting and diarrhea and it looks like what people refer to as gastroenteritis or the quote, the intestinal flu. In both instances, it's usually self-limited. So it simply runs its course and goes away. Now, when somebody comes in and says, I was at a banquet last night, and 20 of us, who all had the same, you know, rubber chicken dinner, got sick, then it's very easy to make the diagnosis of food poisoning because it would be, you know, extremely unlikely that everybody came down with flu at the same time. All right. So in the settings of large populations, similar symptoms simultaneously, food poisoning is pretty easy to identify. And then you can usually go back to the food source, the kitchen, the supplier, and track down, you know, where the offending agent came from. Now, as it relates to the almonds, I personally have never heard that. Almonds in and of themselves, to my knowledge, don't harbor bacteria, so these must have been contaminated by something else that came in contact with them during the either transportation or processing process.
This happened twice, and I won't mention the brand names that were recalled, but it was about a month apart. And these were products that are sold in major supermarket chains, and one was a major brand. So I guess it's stayed in my mind because I'd never heard of it before, and for it to happen twice within a month or a month and a half, I was a little concerned, and I guess that's what led to the food poisoning question,
right?
Because it seems like quite you would not suspect it if you were. If you did get sick from that, I doubt if you would mention it to your physician.
Right.
And as I said, if we have these untreated cases, is there a long-term effect, or is this something that, like you said, is self-limiting, and once you're better, you're better?
To the best of my knowledge, there isn't any long-term effect, though a couple of the groups that you mentioned, you know, seniors or, you know, infants, to the extent that somebody becomes very, very dehydrated, you know, that can be in and of itself a serious medical condition. But the majority of cases of intestinal flu or even food poisoning generally don't get to that point. I personally don't think I would give up necessarily eating almonds. Salmonella is typically something associated with poultry, most commonly in terms of food poisoning source. So I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with almonds, but it would raise the question of what's going on in the processing of that particular product if they've had two outbreaks.
Would it be possible that they transported the almonds in the same container that had been previously used for maybe chickens or something?
Boy, I hope not.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Other questions are welcome. We're a little bit past the midpoint. This is the program that we call Talk to the Family Doctor every other month. We do it here in the 11 o'clock hour of the show on a Monday. And our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana and deals with a lot of different things in his practice. So if you have questions, he will, I know, see if he can help you out here in Champaign, Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The next caller up here is on line number one, and we'll just go right there. Hello.
Hi. I wonder if the doctor could tell me, is there anything or any particular specialist that you'd see for sudden hair loss? It seems like my hair has been shedding for several weeks.
Hair loss can be the result of a variety of different causes. In young women, it frequently follows pregnancy, in which case we just tell folks that it'll grow back. There isn't any specific treatment for it. In folks who have poor nutrition, hair loss is sometimes a problem. Folks who have overactive thyroids will sometimes experience hair loss. If there's evidence of mechanical trauma, basically any kind of hairstyle or chemical application that could potentially damage the hair, again, you could have some hair loss there. There are some localized forms of hair loss where only just little patches are missing. Those are sometimes treated with cortisone medications. The whole general topic would need to be sort of investigated in light of the general health of the patient, the medications that they were taking, certainly certain chemicals. People most commonly, associate chemotherapy with hair loss. So there are a variety of things that would need to be sort of asked. If you think it's definitely a scalp or skin-related problem, chatting with a dermatologist is not unreasonable. But this is a place where it might actually be reasonable to start with your family physician and let them sort of sort out from a medical standpoint where the most likely area is to further investigate.
Okay, thanks.
All right, and we'll go next to Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I didn't hear you say two. So
oh, yes, go ahead.
My question is about things we put on our skin, especially in the summer, and specifically DEET. Being elderly and having rather thin skin, I wonder how safe that is, and also with little children, the mosquito repellent.
Right.
We don't want the
West Nile virus.
West Nile virus, right. but how about the DEET?
This is one of those situations where you have to sort of weigh the risk versus the benefit. If you're outdoors a great deal and are becoming a target for lots of mosquitoes, then it's probably a reasonable thing to try and minimize that. I'm not aware of any consequences to long-term use of these types of products that contain DEET, but they're not something that generally is thought to be systemically absorbed.
Okay.
The amount of exposure would be quite small.
They have all these warnings on the packages, and it makes you wonder. So, okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. There is some reason to be concerned about very small children. Is there?
Any topical medication in children is actually a fairly large dose compared to an adult because their surface area to body weight is actually a higher proportion than an adult. Mm-hmm. And it's thought that there would be some potential for increased absorption through the skin in that area. But how much can you use for how long without causing a problem? I don't know.
Nobody knows. Okay. Well, let's continue. Matt Toon is next here, line number four. Hello.
Good morning, doctor. Thank you. Your advice, please. In late February, I had gallbladder surgery. About 3 weeks later, I ate some nuts. I had a severe pain that sent me to the emergency room. It passed, and I have been having these severe colics once in a while, which is much worse than before the surgery. I went to my family doctor. He ordered sonograms, and they said I have a stone in the tract, either that or some debris left. But my question is for you, number one, okay, they also ordered a procedure to get this stone out. My question is whether, well, first, where did this stone come from? And secondly, should I have a second opinion, or what is my best route? Thank you.
Okay. I believe, if I understand your situation correctly, you have a situation that isn't unheard of after gallbladder surgery. Most people are having their gallbladder removed because they have gallstones that are causing problems as they attempt to exit the gallbladder. They basically get stuck in the little drainage tube from the gallbladder. And so if you remove the gallbladder that contains the stones, then you generally take care of that problem. What's usually not removed with gallbladder surgery is that tube that runs all the way from the gallbladder down into the intestinal tract. And this is called the common bile duct.
Mm-hmm.
And it is possible to have a stone or, as you put it, kind of gravel-like debris in the common bile duct. And it will produce symptoms very, very similar to the same symptoms that you got when your gallbladder was still there. Now, in this particular situation, I believe the procedure that you've probably been recommended is called ERCP.
Mm-hmm.
Endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatography would be a situation where a flexible lighted tube is passed through your mouth, down the esophagus, through the stomach, into the first part of the small intestine. And what they're going to be looking for is the opening of where the duct from your gallbladder empties into your small intestine. And when they find that, what they can usually do is make a wider opening. They can pass an instrument into that opening and basically make it bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And that should then allow a small stone in the duct or debris to flow out. And that should prevent the colic from reoccurring.
Okay.
In this particular case, you know, if you wanted a second opinion, asking a gastroenterologist, who is usually the person who does the ERCP, about your situation would be quite reasonable.
Okay. So you suggest that, or is simply I should just go ahead and not ask for the second opinion?
It's entirely up to you as to what you're comfortable with. If you have additional questions about your situation, I think it's always appropriate to either ask your original physician, and if you don't get the kind of answers that you think you need, then it's perfectly reasonable to get a second opinion. But obviously I'm going with the information that you're giving me, and I don't have access to anything else.
Right, right. But so this stone, it's not that it ran out of gallbladder during surgery or something that was left or escape or slid.
No, they
into
can
the duct.
They can actually be formed in the duct themselves.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. To Danville next, line number three. Hello.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I know the doctor cannot diagnose this over the phone, but I think I twisted my knee last week moving furniture because the pain came suddenly and it's still here. And I don't think it would be maybe not arthritis, like for a knee replacement, a pain. I don't know, it's on the side of the kneecap, and it hurts a little bit up on my side of my leg. You think it's maybe a tendon or tendonitis?
Well, there would be three things that we would ask you about your knee that would make us suspicious that you did something bad to the inside of the knee joint.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have sudden pain that's associated with swelling of the knee.
Yeah, no, it's not swollen.
Not
really.
Swollen.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, that's a good thing. If the knee locks in place, your knee is a hinge joint. You should be able to fully extend it, fully flex it, and it shouldn't get stuck.
It does not, but it pops a little bit on the sides.
That's not necessarily unusual.
Oh.
So if it doesn't lock, that's a good thing. When you're standing on it,
yeah.
Does it give way? Does it buckle?
No, it does not give away, but it hurts when I walk.
Yeah. Those three symptoms in association with sudden pain, if it's swollen, if it locks in place, if it gives way, those are all signs that potentially you've done something bad to the inside of the joint. Now, in some instances, people will twist or otherwise strain their knee, and they will indeed flare up some underlying arthritis.
Yeah.
That'll usually settle down with some ice applied to the joint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some anti-inflammatory agents, the ibuprofen-type medications, if you don't have any other medical reason not to take them.
Yeah, the only thing deep out of my stomach.
Right, and that's we often have to caution people about taking that, and it should always be taken with food.
Yeah.
And in many instances, that just time, ice, rest, and some anti-inflammatory agents, a flare-up of arthritis will settle down. In some instances, a cortisone injection can be helpful to settle down an arthritic flare.
And rest, right?
And rest.
Yeah, well, I don't do that. That's too bad. But let me ask you, this ice, how often?
Usually would do 15 to 20 minutes, three or four times a day.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you. Very good.
And we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic in Urbana. This is the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that whatever's on your mind, we can take a wide range of health questions. If you'd like to chat with the doctor, you can do that. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And our next caller is here in Urbana, line one.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. This is a question also about the encephalitis, West Nile virus.
Mm-hmm.
If you get it, can you get it a second time?
I'm not aware that protective antibodies necessarily remain in your system. So I believe it would indeed be theoretically possible, next year or the year after that, if properly infected again, that you could indeed get it.
You could get it a second time.
Yes.
Okay. Now, if they can make a vaccine for horses
mm-hmm.
and have for years and years and years, are they working on for us mortals?
I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. The incidence of serious disease with this particular virus is probably low enough that it might not be reasonable to try and vaccinate everybody.
Well, you've answered my questions.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
What kind of symptoms do you see with somebody who has West Nile? And is it again one of those things where if you have an individual that's generally healthy, they might have it and not feel great, but also not feel so bad that they decided they, have to go to the hospital.
Exactly. And that is probably the typical West Nile case, is an otherwise healthy individual gets a mosquito bite, the virus gets transmitted, they have a relatively brief flu-like illness, it resolves on its own, they don't seek medical care, or if they do, they're told, well, you have the flu, it'll go away, and it does. The cases that basically show up and get reported are the ones where people come in with high fevers, bad headaches, come to the hospital, end up getting a spinal tap. The cultures on the spinal fluid show no growth of bacteria. So it's not the, you know, spinal meningitis that you think of in terms of people, you know, quickly dying and succumbing. And then they can go ahead and do testing on the fluid to look for particular types of viruses. There is no particular treatment for it. I mean, there's no one specific antiviral agent that makes, you know, the West Nile virus go away. So the treatment generally is supportive. You're doing the test basically so that you can tell everybody around them, no, they didn't have bacterial meningitis. No, you're not at high risk of, you know, coming down with something really bad. So in this particular case, those probably represent, you know, the tip of the iceberg, those cases that end up getting a spinal tap for West Nile encephalitis, but there's probably a large iceberg underneath of people who have certainly the illness but not sufficient enough to warrant medical attention. And consequently, whether it's reasonable to try and vaccinate everybody to avoid those other few cases, you know, would be debatable from a public health standpoint.
Okay. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign. Line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had an angiogram several months ago, and I was really shocked to find that I had one of my kidneys wasn't functioning. So I have kind of two questions. One was I do have regular checkups, and I was wondering, was there a way of knowing that this was happening, or I have no idea how long it's been, or...
I'm going to have to go way back here. Why did you have an angiogram done?
Oh, I had intermittent claudication.
In your legs?
Yeah.
Okay. And do you have other risk factors for vascular disease? Do you have high blood pressure?
Well, I have mild heart murmur.
The murmur itself doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Oh,
do you have high blood pressure?
Yeah, but it's under control.
Okay.
I was just wondering, you know, well, that was one question, whether, you know, it came as such a shock because I had no idea.
Well,
if I hadn't had the angiogram, I never would have known.
Right. The risk factors for vascular disease, blood vessel-related problems, high blood pressure, diabetes, cholesterol, smoking, family history, lack
right.
of exercise, all of those things that produce the blockage that caused you to have pain in your legs when you were walking are also the same things that cause the blockage that would limit flow to your kidneys.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, if it only blocks flow to one kidney, the other kidney will basically take over the function.
Mm-hmm.
And so, no, you're not going to necessarily feel bad, and it's not going to show up on any of your blood tests related to kidney function.
Oh, so actually the only way I discovered it was as a result of this angiogram.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, my second question is that a number of medications. I have Rybecki's guide to prescription drugs, and I take Avalide for which is an angiotensin II receptor, and I take that for high blood pressure. And it says, inform your physician. I just noticed it the other day, before taking these drugs, if you have a history of liver or kidney disease.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if I should be concerned about taking Avalide.
As a
result of this one, having only one kidney.
Not necessarily. There are some specific blood tests related to kidney function, which are generally monitored when you're on the type of medication you just described.
Uh-huh.
As long as those tests remain normal, it's not a problem.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We'll see if we can get maybe one more, at least. Callers in Southern Illinois here, line number four. Hello.
Doctor, thank you. I was wondering, what is, I did go to the doctor, and I'm being treated. What is shingle? Why is it called shingle? Why Is it related to the genital herpes?
Shingles.
I am so lost.
I'm not sure I know exactly why it's called that, but shingles is actually the reactivation of the virus that causes chicken pox.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, as a child, you had chicken pox. When the chicken pox appeared to go away, the virus actually remains dormant in the nerve roots in the body. For some, in many instances, unknown reason, it becomes reactivated. Occasionally, people will have an illness, or they'll have trauma, or they'll get stressed, or something will precipitate a change in their immune system that allows this virus to become active again. And it usually comes out in a little band that follows a nerve root. So it has a pattern that's fairly easily recognized. And it basically is, again, self-limited, but there are antiviral medications for this particular type of virus. And cortisone medications are often used to reduce the inflammation and swelling. But this is basically just the reactivation of the chickenpox virus. And this is herpes zoster and not herpes simplex, which is the genital virus infection.
I've been very careful with, you know, well, I am always taking a shower every day, but even more, it happened on my neck,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm even more careful now, and I wash it often, and I put some cortisone.
Mm-hmm.
But do you have to be very careful with your hands and other parts of your body?
No.
No?
No, it's not something that you're going to readily transmit to any other part of the body.
Okay.
No.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. Thank you. Well, at that, I think we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry, we have some folks we can't take, but we've just come to the end of the time. In a couple months, Dr. Swearingen will be back, so we'll be doing it again. In the meantime, thank you very much.
My pleasure, David.
Jeff Swearingen, he's family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here every other month for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Programs here on AM 580 are made possible by a grant from Christopher Svine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Again, a reminder that tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, Sandy Mason will be here for our monthly show on lawn and garden care, monthly at least spring, summer, and early fall. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. And if you have questions on things that grow in the home landscape, we'll take them. Then in hour two, an archive interview from May, I believe, a conversation with writer Steve Almond about his book Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. And right now, we hope you'll stay tuned because coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Good morning. It's a minute and a half before noon. Let's take a look at what's happening now on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. September wheat, 318, up 2 1/4. December, 332 1/4, up 1/4. September, 227 1/4, up 1 1/2. December corn, 238, up 1 1/4. March corn, 246, up 3/4. December, 262 3/4.